From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, our R&B, rockabilly, and early rock and roll week continues with two archive interviews. First, Ruth Brown. In the 50s, she was Atlantic Records' best-selling performer with recordings like Teardrops from My Eyes and Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean.
Mama, he treats your daughter mean. Mama, he treats your daughter mean.
Later, my interview with Laverne Baker. In the 50s, she had hits like Jim Dandy, Tweedledee Dee, and Bumblebee. I spoke with her in 1991, the year she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Jim Dandy to the rescue. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Go, Jim Dandy.
First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we continue our archive series, R&B, Rockabilly, and Early Rock and Roll, with the late R&B singer Ruth Brown. She was one of Atlantic Records' first hitmakers. In the 50s, she was their most prolific and best-selling performer. She recorded over 80 songs for the label between 1949 and 62. She later sued the label for royalties. Her best-known records include Teardrops from My Eyes, 5-10-15 Hours, Mama He Treats Your Daughter Mean, and Lucky Lips. Ruth Brown made a comeback in the 80s when she starred in the Broadway revue Black and Blue, for which she won a Tony Award. She also co-starred in John Waters' 1988 film Hairspray as Motormouth Mabel. In 1993, Brown was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She died in 2006. She was 78. I spoke with her in 1997. Let's start with her 1953 recording of Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean, a song she initially didn't want to record, but it went on to become one of her biggest hits. Started singing in church.
Mm-hmm.
What was the church and what was the music?
Well, that was the rule. You know, my dad, and coming from a Southern family, I don't know. I wouldn't say that because it was a Southern family, that was the norm. But I think that practically any R&B artist, the most of us of my ethnic persuasion, started singing in the church, if indeed at all. You did have any kind of a talent. The understanding was it was something that was God-given, and you had to give that back. And so my father insisted that if I didn't sing in the church, I was not going to sing at all, you know. And then there were those church-going persons who, for whatever the reason, said that what we were trying to do outside the church was the devil's music, you know.
Which
so
you
the
liked
devil
a lot,
got
right?
credit for a lot of good stuff, I tell you, he did.
So what kind of singing did you do in church?
Well, I was sort of twisted between my father's church was Methodist, and they have sort of just flat-footed inspirational spirituals, I call it. I mean, people just didn't jump up and down and shout and show their joy in the Methodist church. But now, on the other hand, in the summer when I went to North Carolina, which where my mother's people were, to work and sharecrop in the fields in the summer, we went to a Baptist church. And it was totally different. It was so joyous. And on the other side, if it wasn't joyous, it was so depressing. You know, there were songs like, "Sit down, sinner, you better sit down. Sit down, sinner, you better sit down. You ain't going to heaven, so you better sit down." If that didn't take your spirit away, nothing did, you know. And then on the other hand, you had "I got shoes and you got shoes. All God's children got shoes. When I get to heaven, I'm going to put on my shoes. Dance all over God's heaven."
Another exposure to music you had was when you were in North Carolina for the summers, working in the cotton fields. A lot
yeah.
of people sang and shouted there. Sing me some of the things you heard in the cotton fields.
Oh, my goodness. "Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, and oh, Lord, have mercy on me. Oh, Lord, have mercy on me. Oh, Lord, have mercy. have mercy on me when the world's on fire. When the world's on fire. When the world's on fire. Lord have mercy. Mercy on me. And then there was like this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Did you sing yourself when you were working in the field?
Oh, occasionally. But I think that by that time I had started to listen on the radios back in Virginia and hear some things that I wanted to really get into musically. Of course, I was exposed, first of all, to country and western before anything else, you know. And then after country and western, the war years, I listened to, like, the Andrews Sisters and Bing Crosby and Vaughn Monroe.
This is on the radio.
Oh, this is radio. Oh, yeah. Well, radio's always been the intermediary, you know. And one thing about radio was that it was one of the reasons that rhythm and blues, as I knew it, eventually turned into rock and roll. There had to be a change because what the kids were hearing, they had the privilege of turning that dial, listening to whatever they wanted to listen to without seeing the color of your skin or who you were or what you looked like. And they were dancing to the music, just like in a lot of other things. This had to make some changes because now was going to be something that was exposed. People were dancing, even though they had ropes down the center of the barnyards and all. When I played the dances, the ropes fell down lots of times, and the white kids and black kids danced together. Nobody said a thing about it until some big official, a sheriff or something, would come up and say, stop the music, and put the ropes back in place. So the music itself had already started to become the common denominator. You know,
mm-hmm.
I've seen long before Dr. King and everybody started their marches and protests, which eventually we knew would happen. But I've seen the music be so effective long time before that.
We're listening back to my 1997 interview with Ruth Brown. We'll hear more of it after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 1997 interview with rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown. She was one of Atlantic Records' first hit makers. She recorded over 80 songs for the label between 1949 and 62. Ruth Brown, you started your singing career singing mm-hmm. at USO clubs.
Yes.
Was this during World War II or after?
Well, it was between 1941 and 1945, you know, which was Pearl Harbor. Was December 7, 1941, and these were the war years.
Well, you were a teenager. You were in your early teens during part
indeed
of this.
Indeed I was.
So what was it like for you as a young teenager to be singing for soldiers?
Well, to tell you the truth, I sort of snuck in to sing with the soldiers. My dad didn't know it in the beginning because I had gotten a job working at the USO, working behind the soda fountain. And so I was allowed to go into the USO because I had a part-time job in there, so everybody thought. But my basic reasons was to get in and work and sing with that little USO show that was rehearsing there quite often. Now, I was supposed to be in choir practice, and my dad walked in one night unannounced, and I was up on stage. I'll never forget, I was singing Chattanooga Choo Choo. And I tell you, my dad, he just didn't have to say a word. He had a look about him, you know, and there was something in his stride, you know, when he walked. And all he did was walk to the edge of the stage and look straight up at me and beckon. You know, he didn't open his mouth. All he did was come to the edge of the stage, beckon, and point, like with his finger, and say, come on down, you know. And you knew what he meant, and you knew what to expect when you got down off of that stage. I met the Force. May the Force be with you. The Force was with me even then when I came down, because my dad didn't even wait for me to get outside the building. He decided that if I had ignored him, then he was going to make what I had done public. And he gave me my whipping right there in public, you know. Of course, that didn't stop me. I kept sneaking around trying to sing with these shows, and did quite a few of them.
You say at some point that you realized that you could make more money singing two nights a week than your father could make working a full week.
That's right.
And I'm wondering, as a girl, what impact that realization had on you?
Well, it was really important because I was the oldest of eight children. As the oldest, I was the first one that had to go to work. My dad was a dockhand and a laborer. And I know that he made up to $35 a week, which was big money for him. But when I went out and sang and earned $35 in one night, I knew that something here was wrong. You know, something was definitely wrong. And I'm sure that had it not been for the fact that he was a young father with all these children, if the opportunity had presented itself, he very possibly could have been a great singer, because he had a wonderful baritone voice. And I look back on all of that, I realize he was very, probably very frustrated sometimes, because he saw in me a lot of what could have very possibly mm-hmm. happened for him, you see?
You won one of the Amateur Nights at the Apollo
yes.
sessions in, I guess it was the late 1940s.
Yes.
And then must have been 1948 or 49, Atlantic Records wanted to sign you. And they were going to bring you up north again, this time for a paid date at the Apollo.
Yes.
What happened to you when you were driving up north to play the Apollo?
I remember it well. Outside of Chester, Pennsylvania, I'm still not sure what happened. Maybe the gentleman driving might have gone to sleep at the wheel. I don't know. All I know is that I remember a screeching of tires, and I remember a crash, you know, and I remember then finally hearing somebody say, the girl in the back is dead, and that they were talking about me. And finally, when they came to move me, when they went to straighten my leg, my left leg had been broken three or four places and was back up under my body. They tried to straighten me out to pick me up, and that's when I screamed. And they realized that I was indeed not dead, just in a state of shock.
You were unable to talk until then?
Yes, I couldn't speak. I did end up in Chester Hospital and was there for 11 months and something. In fact, my contract with Atlantic was signed while I was a patient in the hospital. They came over for my 20th birthday and brought the contracts, and I signed them on my bed in the hospital there at Chester. And when I finally did get out of the hospital, they brought me to Philadelphia, and I stayed up in North Philadelphia on Butler Street with Cab Calloway's sister, Blanche Calloway.
I guess this brings us to your first record, made in 1949.
Yes.
For Atlantic Records. It
yes.
was called So Long.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell us about your memories of this first recording.
I remember
session.
Going in the studio on crutches to do this tune. And in fact, it was not my record session at all. Atlantic was at that time recording a section of music with Eddie Condon. It was Eddie Condon, Sid Catlett, Bobby Hackett, Joe Bushkin, Ernie Caceres, you name them, the great musicians were there, and they were doing something called Cavalcade of Music. I don't know if it was Herb or Ahmet who had the bright idea to include me on one of the tracks in there, just to sort of get me, you know, they found this opportunity that they could put me on this album with Eddie Condon, which they did. But not thinking that the single that they had me on was going to take off the way it did. And that was the very first tune that I'd recorded, a tune called So Long, that I'd heard a young singer years back when I was still in Virginia called Little Miss Cornshucks. She had done this tune, and I used to hear it by her. Her real name was Mildred Cunningham, one of the most interesting little artists I've ever seen. She used to sit on the side of the stage with her legs hanging over, with a straw hat and bare feet and a straw basket. And they would put one little light on her, and she'd sit there and sing this song, So Long. And people would walk up and put money in that basket. I've never seen anything like her since that time, with the exception of maybe Judy Garland, who sat on the side of the stage and sang Over the Rainbow. But I saw Little Miss Cornshuck sit on the side of the stage long before I saw that, you know. But that's where I got the song.
Well, Ruth Brown, let's listen to your version, your first recording, 1949, of So Long.
So long. Hope we'll meet again someday. Hope that maybe then you'll say, darling, you've been mine so long.
That's Ruth Brown, her first recording made in 1949. Ruth Brown, this recording made the rhythm and blues charts.
Mm-hmm.
But your next few records didn't do as well.
Mm-hmm.
Was it hard for you to find the right material?
Yes, it was in a way, but as I said, I didn't have that much to do about it. And I think that one of the things that made the difference was that when I went with Atlantic Records, I was the first female on that label. And I consequently had an opportunity to hear all of the good material when it came. And they had a lot of wonderful staff writers over there, you know, like Rudy Toombs and Tony Orlando and Bobby Darin and Neil Sedaka, and Otis Blackwell, and Lieber and Stroller, all these young men who were writers and bringing material. But as long as I was with Atlantic in those early years, and they had not become as big a label, but when they started to fill out with other performers and their roster got so big, I wasn't the one to see the good material all the time. You know, there were a lot of ways for it to be spread around. Mm-hmm. And I think that somewhere that's where I felt as though we sort of lost track of each other, because I didn't get some of the good material again. And then once again, the record company had become so big and were continuously becoming bigger. They had people now like Ray Charles and the Clovers and the Drifters, and they had, who else, Roberta Flack and Aretha Franklin, and you name it. You know, the Laverne Baker was there by that time, so Ruth Brown wasn't the one that always got the good material.
When you became a rhythm and blues star, you toured with some of the rhythm and blues and rock and roll shows, and I'm wondering if you could give us a taste of what it was like for you as a performer to be in those rock and roll shows.
Oh, it was wonderful, but of course, they came along a little later. I think they started, there was a father and son team out of West Virginia who booked all those shows called the Super Shows. The Weinbergs were the promoters, and they put these shows together. They had this brilliant idea. And at one time, there were people on the bus like the Clovers, the Drifters, the Five Keys, Lester Young, Buddy Johnson's orchestra, Ella Johnson, and then you would have like a Sam Cooke, you know, and you would have a John Coltrane, and you would have Paul Huckabuck Williams and Charles Brown and Roy Brown. And sometimes there were about 10 acts on one bill, and the ticket only cost about $7.50, you know.
So you're saying
it was wonderful.
Did Lester Young share the bill with the Drifters and the Clover?
Oh, of course, with me.
Uh-huh.
Of course.
Must have been an awfully interesting bus ride.
It was interesting, but we were so young and naive, I didn't realize the greatness of a lot of these people I was working with. I even worked with Joe Louis, the heavyweight champion of the world. A lot of people don't know that, but he went on the road and toured with me and did comedy. you know?
What kind of comedy? Did you?
He did just what it is he does. He played the boxer, and he had a little guy with him named Leonard Reed who played his second. He was the one that he was always trying to punch out, you know. And Joe came out with us when he lost his heavyweight title to Ezra Charles. He came on the road and rode the bus with us.
Huh.
Joe Louis, Billy Eckstein, the Count Basie Orchestra, Nipsey Russell, my dear friend, Red Fox. You talk about shows. You will never see anything like that again.
We're listening back to my 1997 interview with Ruth Brown. We'll hear more of our conversation after a break, and we'll hear from another rhythm and blues star, Laverne Baker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I wanna go north, east, south, west, every which way, as long as I'm moving.
Long as I'm moving.
Long as I'm moving.
Long as I'm moving.
Long as I'm moving, baby, I don't care. Trailer truck. You got big broad shoulders built like a trailer truck.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from the station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And from Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing the number 27 Medicare.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my 1997 interview with rhythm and blues star Ruth Brown. She was one of Atlantic's first hitmakers and recorded over 80 songs for the label between 1949 and 62. She was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1993.
Was there ever a point during your adult life when you couldn't earn a living singing and you had to do other jobs?
Oh, yes, of course.
What did you do?
Of course. I did domestic work. I drove a school bus.
You did domestic work after you had rhythm and blues hits?
Oh, sure. This was during the 60s. That wasn't too long ago. This was during the 60s, the advent of the Beatles and the British invasion. And the business became a little more complicated. But that wasn't really the reason I left, because I really chose... Somewhere down the line, it started to sort of ease back because I had two wonderful children and I wanted to spend more time where they were. And it went back a few years before that I had thoughts of it, because my mother used to take care of my sons. And I remember coming home one time to visit my only tied to my children had been material things, you know, things that you could send money home for and purchase gifts. And I came home, and my oldest, of course, was jovial and jumping up. But my baby, who my mother had chosen for her own, the only thing she didn't do was give him birth. That's why she loved him so much. When I went to reach for my baby, he didn't want me to touch him, and he screamed and yelled, you know, and I think that was probably the first day that I said to myself, well, I got to do something about this. And that was one of the reasons that I finally decided to come in, so to speak. But in those times, I did many things. I did domestic work. I cooked. I worked in daycare. I worked in the home for retarded children. I worked in drug abuse as a counselor. I drove a school bus. I worked in Head Start. I worked wherever I could bring a paycheck home, you know.
Well, how did you feel after the adulation that you'd get on stage cleaning other people's houses?
Well, I didn't feel anything about it because what I was doing was earn a living, a clean, decent living. And it was what my mother had done all of her life, so I felt no shame about it because I did that with as much dignity as I do anything else. I did a good job. I was a good housekeeper, you know. And it wasn't until my needs were of such that I was cleaning house one day and I heard my music. I heard a disc jockey talking about my greatness and how great Ruth Brown was. And at that time, I think I was scrubbing a floor. And that is when I sort of made up my mind that there was some money that belonged to me that I had not been receiving. You know, I had not gotten a royalty statement in almost 30 years. I hadn't seen one, you know. And my records were being sold all over the country, and he was talking about how big this was in Japan and in Germany, and I had no idea about this. So I began this battle, this uphill battle it was, to maintain and reclaim something that was really mine. I refused to beg because I was going to fight for I knew what was mine. You know, if these records are being sold, then I'm entitled to my part of whatever they're being sold for. And I finally, now after all these years, I'm getting record royalties back again for the first time in many, many years, you know.
You made a comeback in the 80s with a series of music theater reviews, including Black and Blue. And I'm wondering now how, when you're performing on stage, the feeling and the audience compare with the earlier part of your career in the 50s.
I cannot explain to you what it's like now. It's kind of awesome. But the beautiful thing is that there are a lot of young faces out there that are now becoming aware of this music that I was a part of. And a lot of them, not because they knew my music, but I did another crazy thing one day. I did a film called Hairspray. And I gained a whole following of new young people with that crazy movie.
It's a great movie. It's a John Waters movie.
Yes, ma'am. With Ricky Lake.
Yeah, with Ricky Lake. It was her first big role.
Yes, yes.
And it's about one of those dance shows in Baltimore.
It was
kind of like
an
American Bandstand, but one set in Baltimore.
It was a real show. Yeah. I remember the reality of it. And it was in a time when John Waters was a young man. He grew up hearing that. And I remember those situations very, very well.
Uh-huh.
And I had said, well, I'm not going to do this film, especially when they took me to wardrobe and brought that white wig out. I said, not on your life, you know. But, of course, it was I can't call his name. He died.
Divine.
I call him the Divine Divine. He came to me and said, girl, put that wig on your head and make some money. And I said to him, no, I'm going to lose every fan I've got in the world if I come out with this white wig. And Divine said, well, I tell you what, for every one you lose, I'm going to bring you two. And every time I see that film, and it runs continuously, and I've gone into grocery stores and see young people following me around, my ego says, oh, they know who I am, Ruth Brown, that kind of thing. And then they will eventually say, Aren't you Motormouth Maybelle?
That was your role in the movie.
That was my role and continues to be my claim to fame. You know, that cult film has really been wonderful. I go to the mailbox quite often now and find a little check with John Waters, God bless him, on it. He writes to me and sends me crazy Christmas cards and things until this day.
I would like you, Ruth Brown, to choose, if you have one, your favorite of your early recordings, and we'll play that.
Oh, there are so many that were good, but I think if I had to choose one, it would probably be, at this point in my life, Oh, What a Dream.
And why are you choosing that one?
Because this whole life has been a dream. I tell you, when I look back at it, I can't believe some of the things that did happen. And when I look back on it now, it's, I don't know. It seems like a dream. That's what it is, you know?
Well, let's hear your 1954 recording, Oh, What a Dream.
Woke up this morning and I looked around, so disappointed. Oh, what a dream, what a dream I had last night. Dreamed I held you in my arms, but I'm still waiting for that day to come. Oh, what a dream, what a dream I had last night. Dream we were walking down the aisle. The organ was playing, here comes the bride. You looked down at me, you began to smile. When I looked around, everybody began to cry.
That's Ruth Brown, recorded in 1954. Well, Ruth Brown, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. I've done all the talking, you see. I always warn people, you know, I say, whenever I get a chance to be interviewed, don't ever say, tell me something about yourself, because, honey, I got about 60 years here to talk about. But you've been very kind.
And I've enjoyed hearing your story. And
thank you
very, very much. Ruth Brown recorded in 1997. She died in 2006 at the age of 78. In 2016, Brown received a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. Coming up, we talk with another rhythm and blues star, singer Laverne Baker. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV. With new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Up next in our archive series, R&B, Rockabilly, and Early Rock and Roll, we have an interview with rhythm and blues singer Laverne Baker. Baker was one of Atlantic's first big success stories, with hits like Jim Dandy, Tweedledee Dee, and Bumblebee. I spoke with her in 1991, the year she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It named her 1956 recording, Jim Dandy, one of the 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. Let's hear it.
Jim Dandy to the
Jim Denny, he's the kind of guy never liked to see a little girl cry. Jim Denny to the rescue. Go, Jim Denny. Go, Jim Denny. Jim Denny to the rescue. Jim Denny to the rescue. Jim Denny to the rescue. Go, Jim Denny. Go!
Laverne Bicker, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Now, you just performed last weekend at the Village Gate, a club in New York. What did you sing? What's in your repertoire now?
Well, right now, the people are so interested in hearing my old recordings. So that's basically what I'm doing with a few other songs. But I'm putting my act together for California, which I will be doing other songs to show the versatility of my voice. But the people, I know, God bless them, they just want to hear what they like. So that's what I do here.
Now, in the 20 years or so that you weren't performing in the States, you were living in the Philippines?
Yes, I'm the show director for the United States Marine Corps. I book all the shows in the club, and on Fridays and Saturdays, I sing myself. And for the happy hour, you know, I laugh and talk with the guys, go around, you know. It makes them feel good and keeps up the morale. That is my job, to make everybody laugh and happy.
What kind of other talent did you book for the shows?
Well, I booked all Filipino talent. And we book whatever I think is suiting for the club. You know, if they've had too much singing, then I'll bring in, like, acrobats and tumblers and stuff like that. It's whatever I feel that we're needed, you know. And it's like if the ships are coming in, then I book the show full of beautiful girls because the guys don't want to see no guys, you know. So when the carriers are coming in, it's quite wild there. You know, we have sometime like 8,000 guys at one time, you know, in there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to another one of your hit records from the 1950s before we talk some more. And why don't we listen to Bumblebee?
Oh, wow.
And I think, you know, this is kind of a novelty record, but it's a wonderful recording.
Yes, I'm singing it now, and I feel so very, very funny singing that.
Why do you feel funny about it?
Well, because I was, you know, very, very young, and at the time it fitted me, you know. It was good, and I had a big hit with it with the kids. But now I'm much older. I feel funny singing it, you know, but I'll do it. You know, I do it. And I'm surprised that my voice can reach the squeaky part now. I still can do it. So I do it. You know, if someone asks for it, I'll do it.
Okay, let's listen to Laverne Bicker, and this is Bumblebee.
Shut up.
Evil bumblebee. I gave you love as sweet as honey. My life, my soul, and all my money. You didn't seem to realize you had a home in paradise.
Shooey, you hurt me like a bee.
A bumblebee, an evil bumblebee. One kiss before you go. Don't ever come back no more. Now, baby, there's no need of crying. I'm sick and tired.
So my guest Laverne Bicker is recorded in 1960. Now, Laverne Bicker, you were born in Chicago, and you started performing in your teens.
Yes.
And when you started performing in clubs around Chicago, you were known as Little Miss Sharecropper. Who gave you that name?
Regretfully, yes. Some guy. Well, it was a long story. It's like at the big club, De Lisa, which was the place during those early 40s, 50s in Chicago. And they had a singer there named Little Miss Cornshuck. She was a great singer. And she used to come out with a little, like, Bo Peep outfit on with a little basket and ribbons in her hair. And she was, oh, quite famous. Her name was the Talk of Chicago. And she got on the wrong path, you know, and wasn't able to perform. So then they were looking for someone to take her place. And I got the job. And the next thing I knew, they had put these little costumes and ribbons and baskets in my hand, and they called me Little Miss Sharecropper because they couldn't use corn shuck, you know, and sharecropper was related to that. But about 2 years after I left, I hurried up and got rid of it. So,
did you protest when they wanted to outfit you that way? And
no,
call you
I
that?
Didn't. You know, you got to get your foot in the door before you can say anything in regards to what you do. You know, I wasn't strong. I just wanted to get started, and I didn't care how, you know, as long as it was legit, you know. But, you know, as I got a little older, I wanted to change, and I did change. And I made it. I went to Basin Street East with Louis Armstrong more than one time, you know. And I played Vegas. And these are rooms and things that I could not get when I was in rock and roll. So I had to change my act, you see.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were one of the first black singers to cross over to a white teenage audience.
Yes.
In the 1950s. Was there a conscious attempt at Atlantic Records to give you a certain kind of material or to change your stage act in any way to help you cross over?
No. The music, Atlantic always picked my music, Ahmed and Jerry at the time. They always picked, you know, the songs that they wanted me to sing or they thought that would be best for me. And I never argued at that particular time. I'll fight now, but I didn't argue then. And because they knew what they wanted, you know. But coincidentally, the things that they gave me, I enjoyed doing at that time. So I gave my best at it, you know. And sometimes they would come in the studio and play different things and holler in the background, you know, to make it better, you know, sound like more people.
Did holler in the background on the record?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which
yeah.
record did they do that on?
Quite a few. They'd sing with at that time we had a group called, a backup group called the Q's. And a lot of things he'd come in and he'd show them, he'd sing with them to show them what he wanted, you see. And this is the way we worked back then, you know. We had a small room and it was, like they were on one side and we were on the other, and, you know, and we made millions of hits up there in that little hole that we were in.
Now I want to play Tweedledee Dee, but you know the voices that come in at the beginning,
uh-huh.
They're kind of square sounding voices, don't you think?
Yes, yeah. These are the cues, and one of the cues is the one that wrote Tweedledee Dee, Mr. Winfield Scott. He's the one that wrote it, and that is the longest recording session I've ever had in my life.
What made it so long?
We did 52 takes.
Whoa, you're kidding.
No, I kid you not.
How come? What went
wrong?
Well,
he wasn't satisfied. It was something missing, and during the break, we know they always give us a little break for tea or whatever, the rest of our voices, you know. And I did, I was kidding with it, and I said, hump, be on, bump, bump, like that. And Ahmed said, that's it, that's it. That's how that got in there. You know, it was just something missing that he wasn't. And he's like that now, you know. He knows what he like. And if he don't hear it, he'll keep pushing, you know.
Well, why don't we listen to Tweedledee Dee? And this is my guest, Laverne Baker. This Laverne Baker is recorded in 1955, a song that went up to number 14 on the charts. Big hit for you. Now, how did you feel when you were given the song? Did you like the song?
Yes and no.
What was the yes and what was the no?
Well, it just didn't make any sense to me, okay? You know, and
but the lyric or the
yeah,
text?
The lyric. The music was okay. We had to find the music to really fit it, you know. So I came up with a suggestion of Brazil, if you notice, it's
at the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, dun 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 dun. So, you know, and that's why I was so upset when Georgia Gibbs covered my record, because we worked very hard to stay away from the main track of Brazil, just a little taste of it, you know. And then she recorded my song word for word. I was very upset with this because she used my arrangement. Use your own arrangement, you know.
Georgia Gibbs' cover of your record went up to number 2 on the charts.
I know. It was so many people they thought they had the original, and they didn't. They had hers.
Now, she was a white singer.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Recording your hit.
Yeah.
Were there stations that would play the white singer's version of it that wouldn't play yours?
Oh, yeah. And there were some of them that played hers, and after they found out she wasn't the original, they wouldn't play it anymore. You know, this happened in the whole state of Illinois and Michigan.
We're listening to my 1991 interview with Laverne Baker. We'll hear more of it after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with rhythm and blues singer Laverne Baker. She was one of Atlantic Records' first big success stories, with hits like Jim Dandy, Bumblebee, and Tweedledee Dee.
In the 1950s, you recorded an entire album of Bessie Smith songs.
Oh, I loved it. Now, that's a recording date I enjoyed. I really did enjoy it. I loved the songs. And after I listened to Bessie Smith, and even now that I'm older, when I do her numbers, I sound more like her, you know. I was told that by the bass player and some of the guys who actually worked with Bessie Smith that was still living, Atlantic got some of the original guys that played with her, you know. And they told me, said, man, you really sound like Bessie, you know. I just had one of those big growling voices, I guess, you know. And it's worse now that I'm older.
Well, it's a great album, and it was reissued recently on compact disc.
Yeah.
So let's play something off of it. This is the opening track, and this is Pigfoot.
Oh.
Sounds really terrific. Was Bessie Smith a big influence on you?
No. Let's say singers from that era did, you know. And then my mom and my grandmom, they were all gospel singers in church. So naturally, I grew up in church. You know, that's where most of us come from, you know.
Laverne Baker, I thank you very much for talking with us. It's really been fun to hear from you. Thank you.
And I'd like to thank you very, very much. And you have a nice day.
Laverne Baker recorded in 1991. She died in 1997 at the age of 67. Our R&B, rockabilly, and early rock and roll series continues through Labor Day. If you'd like to hear parts of the series you missed, including our interviews with Scotty Moore, Elvis Presley's guitarist, Carl Perkins, who wrote and made the first recording of Blue Suede Shoes, Johnny Cash, and singer Etta James, check out our podcast. You'll find lots of interviews. And to find out what's happening behind the scenes of our show, get our producers' recommendations for what to watch, read, and listen to, subscribe to our free newsletter at whyy.org/freshair. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our managing producer is Sam Brigger. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Baldonado, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Monique Nazareth, Thea Challoner, Anna Bauman, and John Sheehan. Special thanks to Heidi Simon for her work on today's show. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. Our consulting visual producer is Hope Wilson. Susan Yakundi directed today's show. Our co-host is Tanya Mosley. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at Kresge.org.